This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We still believe that the election was not free and fair. We still believe that the election was manipulated. There are a number of things that we can do.
That's Douglas Mwanzora, an official with Zimbabwe's opposition MDCT, talking about today's court ruling on the election. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations reports that Ebola has spread to a town in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Zimbabwe's top court has confirmed the results of last month's presidential election, clearing the way for Emmerson Mnangagwa to be inaugurated president. The ruling rejects the opposition MDC Alliance's challenge to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's decision that Mnangagwa won with 50.8% of the vote. Reporter Kudzai Zenawashi is in Harare and reporting. And we have Patrick Chinamasa, the ZANU-PF Secretary of Finance, next.
We are very happy that the Constitutional Court has upheld the free will of the Zimbabwean people, which was expressed on 30th of July 2018 when they voted. And this is despite the attacks, after attacks, the barrage of attacks that were launched against ZEC itself and the chairperson of ZEC and the electoral system. There was also a barrage of attacks lodged against the Constitutional Court itself.
The Constitutional Court judges ruled the MDC failed to prove convincingly there was widespread voter fraud. 23 candidates ran, but the top contenders were the ruling ZANU-PF parties Mnangagwa and the MDC alliance's Nelson Chamisa. Douglas Mwanzora is the Secretary General for the MDCT, one of the opposition parties. He says his party doesn't agree with the ruling and the election should have been annulled.
We still believe that the election was not free and fair. We still believe that the election was manipulated. There are a number of things that we can do, but I do not want to preempt the National Executive Council of the MDC, which is meeting next Wednesday, to decide the way forward. But there are a number of options.
But J. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., says all sides need to move calmly.
But are the people appointed figures who can reconcile, who can bridge gaps, or are they going to be hardliners who exacerbate the divisions within society? Probably it's incumbent on everyone to act responsibly. The government needs to restrain security forces from overreacting. It's their responsibility to do so. The opposition also needs to be responsible. Getting people incited to provoke a reaction is not the way to vindicate their objection.
Mnangagwa has served as president since November when the army ousted Robert Mugabe, who had led the country for 37 years. The move came after Mugabe fired Mnangagwa as vice president and took actions that would have placed his wife in a position to succeed him as president. While the vote was considered to be one of the most peaceful and relatively free in Zimbabwe's history, at least six people died when security forces cracked down on protesters a few days after the July 30th vote. There are fears that angry opposition supporters may in the coming days again take to the streets. The United Nations reports that Ebola has spread to a town in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The patient is a doctor living in Oicha Town, an area surrounded by an Islamic militia group, the Allied Democratic Forces. Initial tests for the doctor were negative, but his wife, who traveled to the nearby town of Beni, is infected and he is being tested again after falling ill. Nearly 100 of his contacts have been identified. World Health Organization officials say insecurity is making it hard to access affected areas. The militia surrounding Ocha town are holding aid workers, government officials, and priests. Early in the week, UN peacekeepers escorted health workers to Ocha. So far, the epidemic has infected at least 103, including 63 deaths in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The outbreak, which began on August 1st, is the 10th to hit the Congo since 1976. A military court in Uganda has charged the country's former army chief with illegal repatriation of Rwandan refugees and asylum seekers. It was one of the three charges made against him by Uganda's general court-martial. He was also charged with failing to protect military materials and to account for firearms. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
After over 2 months in detention, the former Inspector General of the Ugandan Police, General Edward Kale Kayihura, has made his first appearance before a military court. Kayihura was arrested in June, about 2 months after he was sacked by President Yoweri Museveni. Since then, no charges had been filed against him, although he was under military confinement. This morning, three charges were read against Kayihura. Among them was helping to illegally return Rwandan exiles and asylum seekers to their home country. Lieutenant General Andrew Guti is the chairperson of the General Court Martial.
Between 2012 and 2016, by omission and commission, aided and abetted the actions of subordinate police officers and others on various occasions without hindrance to kidnap and illegally repatriate Rwandan exiles, refugees, and Ugandan citizens to Rwanda.
Among the people allegedly kidnapped by Kayihura and his accomplices is Lieutenant Joel Mutabazi. He was a former bodyguard of Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who was forcefully returned to his home country. Once returned, he was arraigned in a military court, accused of terrorism, setting up an armed group, and spreading rumors with the intention of inciting the public to rise up against the state. He was also accused of murder, the illegal possession of a firearm, and deserting the military. Mutabazi has since been sentenced to life in prison and stripped of his rank by Rwanda's military high court. Kayihura is alleged to have also repatriated to Rwanda two other critics of President Kagame, Sergeant Innocent Kalisa and Jackson Karemire. Guti also charged Kayihura with illegally giving arms to individuals, including vigilantes.
General Edward Kale Kayihura, between the year 2010 and 2018, on various occasions, allowed the issue of arms and ammunition to unauthorized persons.
The court also heard that during his tenure, Kayihura failed to supervise and account for the arms and ammunition issued to specialized units under his control. The units include the Flying Squad, Crime Intelligence and Special Operations Unit, and the Witness Protection Unit. Kayihura's lawyer, Peter Kabasi, says the charges against his client are fabricated.
He has pleaded not guilty to them. To use his words, subsolutory force. And we shall wait for them to bring the evidence support. In fact, he said it was absurd. They were just absurd. And I think we agree with him. Yeah, we were not aware of these charges. We saw them here. Oh, he's quite confident. He's strong, and he knows these are fabrications.
The court did not heed pleas for bail by his lawyers, and Kayihura has been remanded to a military jail. The case has been adjourned until 4th September. Kayihura, who had been at the helm of the Uganda police since 2005, was dropped in March. Following his sacking and arrest, Museveni expressed disappointment with him for recruiting private individuals into police work, which he said weakened the force. Kayihura's tenure was characterized by the rise of quasi-military organs, the creation of a vigilante group called Crime Preventers, and a crackdown on opponents of the president. His approach to policing was also discredited by a rise in insecurity. human rights violations, armed robbery, and attacks in broad daylight, some of which claimed people's lives. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The past 2 weeks has seen a number of developments in the Uganda politics, starting with the stoning of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's convoy. As mentioned above, five opposition legislators, including Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as pop star Bobi Wine, now face treason charges. His arrest has set off protests by his supporters, both at home and abroad. J. Peter Pham, vice president of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., says the conflict in Uganda represents the start of a generational change. He spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander.
The thing that is different in this case, there are two things primarily. First, it's the role that the military has played in this, in the fact that the court-martial actually released Bobi Wine, and then he has been rearrested by civilian authorities. So it shows there's a little bit of daylight between the government and the military. The second thing is the nature of the opponent under fire. For many years, of course, the leader of the opposition was Kizza Besigye, who is of the same generation as President Museveni. This time around, you know, the opposition leader in question, Bobi Wine, is someone who is of an entirely different generation. He was barely a toddler when Museveni came to office in the 1980s. So he's part of that generation that makes up three-quarters of Ugandans, those who are young people.
So do you see this as a sign of a growing clout for youths and that maybe Museveni has misplayed this a little bit so far?
I think time will tell if he's the incumbent president has misplayed this strategically. But demographically, it's quite clear that time is not on his side. The issue in question, of course, was the lifting of the age limit that the Ugandan constitution has for running for the presidency. There was an age limit that no one over the age of 75 could run. That would have meant that President Museveni, who's currently 73, would be ineligible to run in the next election, 2021. That was lifted despite opposition by Bobi Wine and other parliamentarians. As I said, three-quarters of Ugandans are under the age of 30. That means a majority of the population were not even born when Museveni first took power. So they don't remember what came before him, and all they have is what they have in front of them. And I think that's going to be a major factor, if not in the next election, most certainly in the ones coming up.
And what do you see as the main challenges that Uganda has to tackle to tamp down some of this disenfranchisement?
Certainly economic opportunity. Young people are facing, as we do everywhere, the quest for jobs, for meaning in life, the ability to start families, all of which are economic questions profoundly. So to build an economy that is growing in step with the growing population, that's one. Two, the young people are much more connected today because of technology, and they are better informed about what's going on in their own country and in neighboring countries, and they're seeing winds of change in neighboring countries. Look at what's happening in Ethiopia and other places. So, and they're looking at a leadership that has not changed. It's not that Museveni has not delivered, and certainly an improvement over Milton Obote and Idi Amin before him, but after 32 years in office, people are going to wonder if it's not time for a change, especially young people who've known nothing else. This may be the signaling of a passing of the baton.
That was J. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council, speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. Nineteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The South African government today apologized to white farmers for poor communication about its possible expropriation of their land to speed up agricultural reform and to put more farmland in black hands. The apology comes at the start of a nationwide public consultation process on land reform. 24 years after the end of apartheid, the vast bulk of the country's commercial farmland is owned by whites, who make up only about 8% of the population. Director General of Agricultural, Mike Malengana, today said the proposed constitutional amendment to allow for land expropriation without payment has been misinterpreted as the beginning of a state assault on white farmers. Darren Taylor reports.
A gathering of white and black farmers in Limpopo province has highlighted the many land reform projects that are being driven by white farmers. Some have already given their land to black people and are mentoring them to become fully fledged commercial food producers. Mlengana says it's a pity that the African National Congress government has up until now been ignorant of most of these white-driven initiatives. He revealed that Minister of Agriculture, Senzeni Zokwana, has chastised state officials for not allaying white farmers' fears that their land is about to be taken.
And the minister stands up. You government officials are talking to us DGs. Why have you not gone out and speak to the farmers? There is no thing like that. Where does it come from that we are coming with gun blazings to take white commercial land?
Mlengana also says a list circulating identifying 139 white-owned farms to be taken by the government has been misinterpreted. He says the 139 white landowners are simply asking the government to pay too much for their land, so the state will ask a court to determine a fair price for the farms. Mlengana emphasized that white farmers have a future in South Africa.
Those who are going overseas and doing all that, they are destroying the future of this country. You are killing this country. The day your friends up there kill this country, they are killing the economy of this country. Where are you going to live? Even if you go overseas and say, I'm running to Australia, I'm running, they will distrust you. Because wherever there is a debate, your first interest, not the national interest, matter more.
The Director General says the future of agriculture in South Africa is white and black farmers working together, funded by government.
At this point, you have been using your money. At this point, you have been trying to get there. There is money available that I'm trying to channel towards that partnership.
In the midst of allegations of widespread corruption within the land reform process, Mlengana said the Department of Agriculture is committed to better administration and has to manage taxpayer funds much better. White farmers at the gathering have cried as they've pledged to correct the wrongs of the country's apartheid past. As one put it, our fathers stole the land, and if we are given the chance, we will hand it back, but only to skilled black farmers who are dedicated to producing food for the country. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Bela Bela, South Africa.
Egyptian authorities arrested Ambassador Massoum Marzouk, former assistant to the foreign minister, who had called for a referendum on President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government. Officers also arrested Raed Salama, a senior member of the opposition Dignity Party, and academic Yahya Kazaz, who recently called for Sisi's departure on his Facebook page. Michael Hanna is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation in the United States and an expert on Egypt. He explained to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi why these sort of arrests no longer surprise political figures in Egypt.
Well, for a regime that is very sensitive to all forms of dissent, some that I would class as not even political dissent, creative dissent, it's not surprising that these actions, which I'm sure were seen as provocative by the regime, were dealt with in this fashion. It is in keeping with an approach that wants to squelch any and all political activity. And the recent track record of the regime that has arrested and detained individuals for much less, it is not surprising that this kind of aggressive approach to political opposition was dealt with in this fashion. I think the one complicating factor, of course, is that these are recognizable personalities, a high-profile diplomat, former diplomat, and so these arrests will obviously garner greater attention and scrutiny.
Do we see a U.S. response to such act?
Very low-key, very muted. It's clear that this administration is not particularly interested in commenting on or dealing with these issues of political freedoms. We might get a mention or at least a response to a comment at the level of the State Department spokesperson, but it's clear that the Trump administration is not particularly troubled or interested in the nature of Egyptian politics and the course of repression and authoritarianism that characterizes this current regime.
Michael, no specific charges had yet been laid against the three men, but they were arrested on the orders of Egyptian public prosecutor. Is that legal from a human rights point of view?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is a regime that has arrested tens of thousands of people, so actual legality is not what this is about. Obviously, this is authoritarianism and repression, and this is about regime sustainability and survival. And this is a characteristic that has been repeated over and over again. It's not a shock that now we see this kind of political repression, which is very clearly a human rights violation. But the legal system has become an important tool for repression and squelching the possibilities of any kind or form of dissent or opposition.
But the government says its actions are directed at terrorists and saboteurs trying to undermine the state. What's your response to such justification?
From the viewpoint of the regime interested in stability, it wants no distractions. It sees its job at the moment in never allowing for the conditions that led to the uprising of 2011. There's not going to be another 2011 uprising. And so they believe that the pathway to achieving that kind of stability is to quash any potential opposition that could grow in the future into something much broader that could threaten the regime. These individuals don't represent that. But for the regime, it is a question of what this could become in the future. So we're far beyond the realms of legality or even purported justifications on any kind of legal basis. Threats, even very distant threats that could emerge in the future, are dealt with in this fashion. And the criminal justice system is a very important tool in achieving those ends.
That was Michael Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and an expert on Egypt. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com. On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.